In 1969, the sixth Bond film, directed by Peter R. Hunt, picks up months after the trail to Blofeld has gone cold. That is, until James Bond meets an adventurous young woman, Tracy, whose father has connections that lead the British secret agent to go undercover at a mysterious health clinic in the Swiss Alps, where he comes face to face with his arch nemesis, whose latest scheme is to ransom the world with a nefarious biological weapon. George Lazenby is Agent 007 in On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Good evening, 003. The following is for your ears only and is classified above top secret by Her Majesty's Secret Service. Our contact with the We Can Make This Work, probably, podcast network intercepted an encrypted audio message regarding podcasters assembled. For this season, the podcast network is looking to recruit field operatives from around the world to reminisce about the Bond movies in a countdown to the latest film in the franchise, No Time to Die. Your primary objective is to infiltrate Podcasters Assemble by recording and uploading your submissions at probablywork.com, utilizing a two-way communications device with a built-in microphone, the latest from QBranch. For a full mission report, go to probablywork.com. We're all counting on you, 003.
Assemble. Podcasters Assemble.
Hello, my name is Ben Thompson. I'm from badassoftheweek.com.
Eric Slater here from Epic Fails of History.
My name's Travis Bowe, and I am from the podcast Real Comic Heroes, and that is Real with two E's.
This is Troidal Power from Too Young for This Track.
This is Justin Aki, graphic designer and one half of Significant Otter Co.
This is Megan Aki, the other half of Significant Otter Co.
I'm MC from the best animated shows ever, so far.
Today, we are reviewing
On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Spoiler alert. On Her Majesty's Secret Service is the 11th book, but the 6th movie.
Wow, so we have a brand new Bond.
Okay, guys, someone could have warned the newbie about this movie. This is not like any of the others. It's real. Almost too real at moments.
It's the first of the George Lazenby James Bonds, and also the last.
This is the first and only movie with George Lazenby, an Australian, so at least he's part of the Commonwealth.
This is the first and only Bond movie with George Lazenby in the role.
I did a little bit of digging into the casting of George Lazenby in this role and found out some fun stuff about it.
Lazenby was an Aussie. He was offered a 7-movie deal.
One, he only got his foot in the door because a few months before they started looking for a new actor to play Bond, he went on a blind date for his friend because his friend decided he just didn't want to go on the blind date. And that woman happened to be the woman tasked with finding a James Bond later on. So she called him up and was like, hey, we need you to get in here. I got this role for you. And he was like, what is it? And she's like, can't tell you. And he's like, I'm good then.
Because he was like the most like attractive model in the world. He was like model of the year in 1967 or something.
Now, at this point, he was a model. He was super famous in Germany as a model for chocolate, I guess. So much so that he could afford to drive an Aston Martin and wear Rolexes. So he kind of had the rich swagger of a James Bond already. And eventually he did meet up with her and find out that the role he was being offered was James Bond. So he went out to a salon and got his hair cut in the style of Sean Connery. Actually told him, give me Sean Connery's haircut. Supposedly Cubby Broccoli was actually in the room. Cubby Broccoli is one of the guys who makes the Bond movies. I saw him when he was getting his hair cut and thought that guy could be James Bond. But then he showed up to the audition wearing a Sean Connery suit that he had bought from a dry cleaner when Sean Connery didn't pick it up. And he just popped his head in the door and was like, hey, I hear you're looking for James Bond. And they were like, all right, sold. Get in here, you goof.
And they offered him a 7-movie deal to be James Bond. He did one and then went back home.
The problem was George Lazenby wasn't an actor. And so they're like, well, this is fine. He looks the part. He's got the swagger. He's super arrogant. We can totally make him work as James Bond. It sounds like it didn't work. There was apparently a lot of drama on the set.
And then we got Roger Moore.
But we're not here to talk about behind the scenes, right? We're here to talk about the movie.
And just like Sean Connery's first appearance and Blofeld's first several appearances, you don't get to see Bond's face right away. It's sort of a slow reveal.
One of the bright sides of this movie were the Bond quips.
This is just a great movie. It has heart, action, and you kind of wish Lazenby had come back to finish off the story in the next movie.
Lazenby's delivery was really dry. In some cases, I found myself rewinding just to be like, did I hear that right?
This is probably the most 70s Bond movie of them all. And what's funny is it actually takes place in 1969. But I guess the British were kind of ahead on some of those fashion trends. Seriously, it's very 70s.
If I sat down to watch this in the theaters in 1969 after watching all the Sean Connery James Bonds, I'd have been confused, I'd been sad, I would honestly have just been inconsolable.
It's one of my top five James Bond movies. I really love this movie, and like, I don't think it gets the recognition it deserves. I think it's starting to. I think time has been really kind to this movie.
Okay, movie starts with this badass race, Mercury Cougar and the Aston Martin. They're chasing each other along the beach.
The movie starts with Bond not on a mission.
So this movie kicks off with George Lazenby following a woman to a beach where she's trying to kill herself by walking into the ocean, and he stops her from doing so.
We're introduced to Bond and his future love interest, Tracy, with a drive in Portugal, of all places.
He's just messing around, just driving around, and starts stalking this girl.
Bond stops, he pulls out his little periscope thing, and we think he's being a little creepy, but it turns out he's got to drive his Aston Martin onto the beach like a psycho and run out and save this woman from drowning herself in knee-deep water.
Where he saves her life from trying to kill herself.
He saves Tracy from drowning herself at the beach, I guess. But then he has to fight off her bodyguards, which weren't doing their job, apparently.
Out of nowhere, a couple guys show up. There's a big fight.
Just in time for a couple of goons to show up, who I think they're trying to... Are they just trying to catch her? Do they work for her dad and are trying to catch her? I think that must be what it is. Anyway, James Bond beats the crap out of them. The girl runs away.
We learn quickly that George Lazenby Bond has very quick reactions on just whacking dudes with the first thing that comes into his hands at a moment's notice. So when they throw him into the boat, like they're gonna execute him, he immediately grabs this boarding hook and whips it right at this guy with the wrong end, I think. I think that if you're going to attack somebody with a hook like that, you just want to use the pointy end. But he boxes him with it and knocks him out. And a big fight ensues.
She also runs off after he saves her from herself and some thugs.
The cold open on the beach is full of the most hilarious fight choreography.
The fight on the beach, it's pretty good. I like it. I like that they sped it up a little bit to kind of keep it exciting.
And then she steals his car and drives away.
And I also like that Bond gets his car stolen by this girl, which is going to become a theme. He gets disarmed by her a lot. She steals his car, and we'll see a little bit more of that as we go on.
And he says, "This never happened to the other fella."
He utters, "This never happened to the other fella."
James is left standing on the beach with her shoes and looks at the camera and goes, "Ah, this never happened to the other fellow."
It's a pretty great nod to the audience and one of the first fourth wall breaks in the series.
Also, he's the reason for the whole codename not person theory. I think it's been completely debunked since, which is sad, but it was a cool theory.
This also kind of led to a lot of fan theories that George Lazenby's Bond was actually a different character from Sean Connery. Every Bond actor was actually a different character using the pseudonym of Bond.
Now, this is a great way for them to set up the idea that James Bond is a codename, except for then they don't follow through with it.
There's a lot of holes in this theory, especially when you get to Skyfall. But even though this movie sort of establishes that fan theory, it also throws it away immediately. Because there's a scene after Bond talks to M, I believe, where he's in his office and he's looking back on all his souvenirs from the previous movies, from his previous missions. You know, gadgets and callbacks and whatnot.
There are two great cars in this movie. One, the 1969 Aston Martin DBS, which we don't see much of, except for the beginning of the movie and the end. And Tracy's Cougar, which, holy crap, she can handle that thing. And it beats the crap out of it, too. No gadgets, just great lady driving. I also did notice that Bond still has a rifle in his car, and it's a different car, so that means it's standard issue Q branch.
This never happened to the other fella.
Cut to the credit scene where they show all the old movies in the opening credits. It's actually kind of a cool effect.
So I know I mentioned this on episode 1, but this has one of the best title sequences in the entire series. No lyrics, just awesome music and visuals.
Also, this movie has a banging soundtrack. It's like electronic, but classic.
One thing I would change about the movie is the opening title sequence.
They did this cool thing where they incorporated clips from the previous films, kind of showing that there is a chronology at work here.
We're taken down this memory lane of James Bond without James Bond. You know, we see some of his the former Bond girls and scenes from other movies that just get edited around Sean Connery. And
the song for this movie is almost not worth mentioning because there's no lyrics to it. It's just like some music that plays. What is interesting about it, though, is that it shows like a bunch of footage from the previous Bond adventures in the credits for this one. So it's like making sure that you like connect that this is the same guy, even though right before this was the line about the other fellow, so maybe it's not the same guy. It's a weird choice.
It just doesn't work.
It ties everything together and also emphasizes that despite the joke, this is the same James Bond.
That we've had 5 previous movies that have managed to use lady silhouettes and various creative title sequences, and we should have just gotten another one of those, you know, silhouette ladies and various spy related things that would have totally worked. We didn't need the callbacks to the previous movies.
Bond ends up running into the woman again. We find out that her name is Tracy later.
This movie takes place in Portugal. It's at a hotel out there.
Later on, Bond then saves Tracy from an embarrassing moment in a casino.
We need to talk about the Baccarat scene,
where apparently the national economy is based on smoking as many cigarettes as possible.
I think it's Baccarat. I don't know what this is. This is the card game that James Bond plays that I don't think anybody ever has any idea what's happening. Everybody's speaking French, which makes no sense. And we're in Portugal, so I still don't know why we're speaking French.
He has to cover a bet she made that her ass couldn't cash, but doesn't have the money. It's 3,000 francs, which is about $310 today.
And we don't really know what's going on. It just becomes clear at the end of the game that some random number has been reached and the girl who shows up has lost. And so now James Bond has to do the cool guy thing and he gives her, you know, covers her debt. And in exchange, he gets to have a drink with her. Dom Perignon 57.
Bond's then invited up to her room. Before he does, he orders some Dom Perignon 1957, which actually doesn't exist. See, Dom had a problem with the grape crop from about 55 through 59, so it's a fake wine. It's actually pretty funny.
When he goes to the girl's hotel room, she's a Contessa. When he goes to the Contessa's hotel room, he's attacked by some gigantic dude.
And tries to hook up with her at her hotel, finds out what room she's in, and goes to her hotel. And, oh, there's a goon in there, too! And he gets into a fight with him. Another classic furniture fight where they're throwing chairs around and stuff.
And once again, immediately, the second that guy gets a hand on him, he clubs that guy with a chair. Just moments notice, like he must have already had his hand on the chair. He's got amazing reflexes at clubbing people with something that he can grab within arm's reach immediately.
Anyway, he goes up to a room. He gets his butt kicked in a 1970s style tux.
And at one point, he throws him through like this like decorative wall that's it looks like fencing or perhaps a gate. And he throws him through it and then calls him a gate crasher because he threw him through the gate.
He has a big fight with the guy. It's a pretty good battle. Like, they're fighting it up in the hotel room. Goes back and forth. Finally, Bond gets the drop on the guy, knocks him out, and then stops to eat some beluga caviar on the way out the door.
He gets back to his room, and there's Tracy holding his gun with a boob hanging out of her nightgown, just ready to shoot him, and Bond takes the gun back from her and then slaps her around a little bit because that's how Bond seduces women. But I guess she did have a gun pointed at him, so there's at least some reason for him to assault her, I guess?
And then he smacks Tracy around to figure out what's her real deal before going on with the whole, like, you know, Bond thing.
It's still a weird foundation.
The next morning, he's a gentleman, orders an expensive breakfast, then he gets kidnapped and doesn't get to eat anything until dinner, where he meets Tracy's dad, Draco, the boss of the Union Corps, the Corsican Mafia.
Eventually, we make our way to the headquarters of Draco, head of Draco Construction, and a gangster. He's like a leader of a crime family, basically. There's a cool fight scene here where Bond like fights his way away from the guards who have taken him to Draco's headquarters that has like super fast paced editing. It almost feels like a modern fight scene, like a Jason Bourne type fight scene where it's like poo 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 poo, except instead of going poo 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 poo, it's like kapoof, kapoof, kapoof. It's like there's explosions happening every time Bond punches someone, which is a little over the top.
If there's one thing I could change about this movie, it's Tracy's father. His character is kind of a scumbag. At one point, he tells Bond what she needs is a man to dominate her. What the hell?
Of course, Draco knows exactly about Bond because Bond is literally the worst spy ever, always throwing around his name and drink choices. Eventually, Bond is offered a $1 million dowry to marry Tracy, which is $2,031,950.67 in today's dollars. I mean, I didn't get anything from marrying my wife that she knows of.
Draco explains the plot of what's basically the first, like, third and the last third of this movie. The middle third's like a whole different story. Because basically, Draco's like, I got this daughter. Her name's Tracy. I know you've ran into her a couple times. She's just a crazy child and needs a man to rein her in, because we all know every woman needs a man to rein her in. So here's the thing. You're going to marry her, and I'm going to give you $1 million. And Bond's like, no? And he's like, I'll tell you where Blofeld is. And Bond is like, I'm in.
I will also say, Tracy and the plaid outfit, man, Diana Rigg is hot. Finally, over a quarter of the movie in, Bond is taken off the Blofeld case and tries to resign, but is given a leave of absence instead, thanks to Moneypenny.
In fact, at one point, M is giving Bond shit for not tracking down Blofeld.
He goes over this plan with M, but M explains that he's been reassigned. He's no longer on the Blofeld case, because basically Bond's been like hooked on revenge since You Only Live Twice, I guess. And Q needs him, or M rather, needs him to move on. And so he's reassigning him. So Bond resigns. He has Moneypenny draft up a resignation letter for him, saying, I quit.
Also, he kisses Moneypenny full on the lips.
There's even a subtle little musical hint at Underneath the Mango Tree when he looks at Honey Rider's belt.
Oh, and at one point he was whistling Under the Mango Tree from Dr. No, because that was a cool throwback.
Underneath the coconut tree, me honey and me. Wait, no, it's Mango Tree. Dang it!
Also, why does he have Honey Rider's belt?
And then he goes to see M, and M says approved. And Bond's like, oh my god, I no longer work for MI6? And Moneypenny's like, come on, Bond, I got you. I changed it to a 2 weeks leave request instead of a resignation request. So you're just on vacation for 2 weeks. And Bond's like, oh, sweet.
Favorite love interest? We all have to give credit to Tracy. Finally, someone rejects Bond. Makes him work a little bit. I think that's what he falls in love with.
Tracy was an excellent foil in love interest. First of all, Diana Rigg is a great actress and very attractive. Coming off The Avengers, she was fit and came across as confident and full of life.
One thing I love about this movie is Tracy. She's an interesting character, and she kicks ass and even saves herself.
She's a great driver, which showed during the Winter Demolition Derby. Sorry, Minis and Fiats.
She also happens to be one of the only Bond girls that Bond actually falls in love with.
And he goes off and he meets up with the Countess and they fall in love over the next 2 weeks. We get like montage of them riding horses and kissing on the beach and stuff. And you're like, I guess you're supposed to be like, look at Bond falling in love. But we all know he's just doing it to get information, right? Like he's, because the guy was like, I wouldn't tell MI6 where Blofeld was, but I would tell my future son-in-law. So Bond's intentions are corrupt because he's really just doing it to get information. But whatever, I guess it's fine.
I will say there's an awesome montage. It's like a love story montage played against Louis Armstrong's We Have All the Time in the World.
And it has the love theme, We All Have All the Time in the World. It's still a pretty great song on its own. The cover by Louis Armstrong even charted back in the 90s.
The song's fantastic, and just the lyrics have so much more weight when you think about it, when you know what's coming. It's very bittersweet. And I think that aspect of the movie works very well for the most part. So there's one Q scene in this movie, and it's without Bond. It's actually Q talking to M. It's very weird. Q's really excited about his radioactive lint. Has that ever come up? Has that ever been a gadget in a Bond movie? I'm trying to remember. How would that work? Is it safe?
So, the worst scene in the movie is Bond's partner with the flock of seagulls haircut, whose name is apparently Sean. Well, they break into a lawyer's office, with the biggest gadget being a safecracker.
Really, the main gadget of this movie, the standout prop of this film, is the safe slash suitcase slash printer thing.
My favorite gadget in the movie is the safe cracking slash photocopier that gets used in Burn when James Bond is, I believe he's in the lawyer's office or something, some office relating to discovering kind of the background information on Blofeld.
So Bond breaks into this office to get this information about Blofeld's attempted claim to a legitimate count position. I don't understand British bureaucracy or theocracy or monocracy or anything. Bureaucracy. I don't know. I don't know what it is. But anyway, it's apparently important that he wants to be a count.
And it's just this big device that gets brought in through the window via crane. And it's, like I said, it kind of serves two purposes. It helps him crack the safe. And at the same time, once he gets the documents, it does a nice photocopy job on them. So just a real weird device that, you know, only has one purpose or one specific job that it would work for. So it's a lot of fun.
This massive, like, photocopier, I guess, that a crane has to take over to the window and stuff.
Didn't James have like a tiny safe cracker in his pocket last movie? Something that, you know, that worked fine.
With all of Bond's ridiculous gadgets, it's just kind of funny that they didn't decide to miniaturize the thing. I do love that whole sequence. In the context of the times.
And Bond breaks into the office. There's this cool scene where he like sneaks into the office and then there's a construction thing happening across the street and a guy is there, this blonde dude who's Bond's buddy apparently, and he uses a crane to like bring him the safe cracking device, and then he cracks the safe and copies some documents and then sends this equipment back out through the crane.
How come James had to read like an ancient Playboy while this thing took minutes to do its job?
There's a couple hilarious Bond moments in this movie. He grabs caviar after a fight, and there's this one part where he's looking at a Playboy centerfold.
And while he's sitting there waiting for the safe to crack, Bond just is like reading a Playboy in this dude's office that I don't think Bond took with him. Like, he found a Playboy in this guy's office, is sitting there looking at the Playboy, and then after he cracks the safe, he's at like walking down the hall looking all smug with himself, still reading a Playboy, like in the hallway. I guess that's a look.
Also, he has a copy machine in there. Why? No, literally, why? It's shown later in the movie he has like a Minox camera when he's trying to find the locations of the Angels of Death. Why wouldn't he just take a picture of the documents? The Minox even has a chain to help focus on paper.
One thing leads to another, and eventually that somehow leads to Blofeld.
And then eventually Draco tells him, you know, hey, check out this name, the Duchamp de, I don't remember what it is, but it's the French version of Blofeld, apparently, is what we find out. And it's there's genealogical information to get.
One of my favorite 007 moments was Bond acting like a little book nerd, you know, trying to pretend to be non-athletic and just, oh, hell yeah.
I love how they incorporate Bond's family motto, the world is not enough.
This is where we get into like the other story in this movie, because suddenly the love story goes away because Bond got what he wanted out of the woman, which was for her dad to give him information. And he goes after Blofeld. He finds out that Blofeld's got this like clinic in the Swiss Alps to help women treat allergies. I guess he doesn't know it's women at that point. And he goes undercover as a genealogist investigating Blofeld's claim to this countship thing.
There's a few pretty gorgeous locales in this movie. You got Spain, Switzerland, the Alps. Is that Blofeld's summer home? Like, does he go to the volcano during the winter?
My favorite vehicle in this film is probably the gondola lift. It comes up multiple times, and it's how most people get up to the clinic at the top of this mountain.
And then he gets to the clinic, and it's all women, and Bond is like, oh, what am I going to do?
Anyway, following the destruction of the volcano fortress, Blofeld is in the process of trying to become a count. What's the point of that?
The villain for this one is Blofeld, who wants to be known as Count Balthazar de Blochamp, which is fantastic.
You want a title? Didn't you, like, try to take over the world recently?
I do love how these movies went out of their way to not show Blofeld's face until the last movie, of course. In this one, Blofeld's played by a different actor.
Telly Savalas.
How did Blofeld's face get fixed? We just met him in the last movie with a huge scar on his face. And I'm baffled as to what happened. I know I've heard that the movies and the books are in different orders, so maybe that has something to do with it.
Like I mentioned on the last episode, in the books, this one took place after Thunderball, but before You Only Live Twice. In the movies, of course, this is the follow-up to You Only Live Twice. So there's a few story things that are kinda weird.
I don't know how you're supposed to make that connection as a viewer.
Knowing that, I really would have preferred this movie to take place before You Only Live Twice. It seems a lot more fitting as a first face-to-face confrontation between Bond and Blofeld. They're kind of trying to hide their identities from one another, but it's pretty clear they're kind of on to one another as well. And it would have really added to that reveal of Blofeld in You Only Live Twice. Plus, wouldn't it have made more sense if he got his scar from Bond?
It's a great movie, but it's such a long lead-in to how Bond gets to the villain. There's some great show of skills in Bond here, impersonating the researcher mostly. He can literally BS everyone on the actual things about Haroldy, which I thought was pretty funny. It's crazy. I mean, I wonder if it's some standard 00 training or James crammed on the flight over, because it's insane how long he goes on when he's boring the angels to death, well, to death.
James Bond, we need to talk for a second about how James Bond wears a lot of frills in this movie. He's got this frilly cravat when he goes to meet Blofeld. He's got the frilly vest when he's in the hotel in Portugal.
This movie has Bond in a kilt. It's hilarious.
There's a weird choice of wearing a traditional kilt with apparently a fanny pack in it. So very interesting fashion choices from Bond in this movie.
It's amazing.
Now, it's important to remember, this is the Bond movie that's a love story, and yet he gets to this clinic and immediately sleeps with two of the women there, and then makes an appointment to sleep with the third. That's a little strange.
James Bond is a complete male whore in this movie. For him being really into Tracy, he kisses Moneypenny full on the mouth, hooks up with two random girls at the villain's lair, which granted, at least one of those was necessary, but he starts making appointments at one point.
And my favorite side character is a henchwoman, Fräulein Bunt. She sort of is the one who keeps an eye on Bond with all the young women and captures him in the act of trying to get into bed with one.
There were not that many gadgets in this movie, except the ridiculous photocopier safecracker combo. But I do like the spycraft of Bond breaking out of his locked room. And then he's shown up, like, 20 minutes later when one of the girls has a friggin' nail file, because the girls probably figured out how to break out by day 4 being cooped up there.
Probably my favorite gadget in this film is the mind control technicolored roof ceiling. It is what they use to hypnotize all the young ladies at this place, I guess, to do the thing that they want to do.
But he goes undercover and, like, he investigates, he talks to Blofeld, he's trying to figure out what's going on, he does some curling, and eventually Blofeld is like, hey, you done had sex with two of the women in my clinic, clearly you're not the genealogical professor you're pretending to be.
So you got Blofeld once again in this movie.
You're 007 James Bond, you think I would have recognized you since I just met you in the last movie and almost shot you in the face but then didn't, but he doesn't recognize him for some reason until, whatever.
And his villain plot makes zero sense to me.
His mission this time around is that he is, his evil plan is that he is brainwashing girls to distribute biological agents to the countries of the world. And what he wants in return for this is political amnesty and the title of Count Balthazar de Beauchamp.
Is it mind control? Is he trying to... By curing these women of their allergies, is he also trying to make them asymptomatic carriers of a virus that he's then going to put out into the world so he can make money because he is the only cure?
And he's like, listen, I got this cool plan where I'm brainwashing these women and they're going to release a biological agent that is going to make everything go sterile. Plants, animals, humans, everything's going to be sterile unless I get what I want. But I'm not going to tell you what my payment will be this time. It will be something very different than before.
Blofeld has some of the best lines in this movie. Merry Christmas, 007. I mean what I say and I do what I claim.
And then he locks Bond into, instead of a cell or a room, he locks him into like the engine room for the cable car system at this weird Swiss resort, giving Bond ample opportunity to escape using the best gadget in this movie, which is his pockets. You see, Bond has to climb across this cable, and this cable is very abrasive on my hands, so he rips the pockets out of his pants and uses them as gloves in order to climb on the cable. I love it. That's some good, like, dirty, down-to-earth spy shit. I'm here for it.
Best ally in the movie is a British agent slash climber.
My favorite villain moment is when it's revealed to Bond that his backup, who tries to use the gondola lift and climb up the side of the mountain to help Bond out, is caught. Essentially, we're told he's tortured and then killed. And the way that is revealed to Bond is he's hanging from his climbing equipment off the side of the mountain.
Poor guy.
From this point, we just go into like a lot of action stuff, like tons of action, because Bond gets into like a chase scene where he's skiing down the side of a mountain and he's being chased by a bunch of goons. Then there's a spot where he ends up inside of like a room at the chalet at the ski resort that's just full of bells for some reason. And this is like the most abrasive fight scene I've ever seen in a movie, because every punch they're like knocking into a bunch of bells. So it's just this awful clanging noise constantly. It's a weird call.
I want to talk about the ski scenes, because the ski scenes here are amazing.
My favorite Bond moment is when he escapes being captured, he actually skis down a mountain to escape.
In the first ski scene, we've got James Bond and he's skiing down the mountain, and the skis that these guys are on in this movie are not the same as the skis you're in today. These are like old style, like wooden skis. You can tell one of them breaks, which doesn't happen to skis anymore, really. And the stunts on this are amazing. We get some great jumps, and when Bond breaks a ski and ends up having to go down on one leg, there's a guy really doing that. It's probably not George Lazenby, but somebody's doing that stunt, and it's really, really impressive to watch.
And then after that, he ends up running into the woman. He meets Tracy, and she's like, Bond, what are you doing here? And he's like, there's men after me. Do you have a car? We've got to get out of here. So they get into a car, and then we get into this cool car chase scene. And
he gets to the bottom of the hill. He links up with the Contessa, who's there. And they get in her Cougar Eliminator, and they enter a race, and they just start driving like assholes. She's driving like a fucking psychopath. She's smashing into every car around her. She's basically like horizontal on the track half the time. Blofeld's guys get onto the track. They're driving like maniacs. Everybody's crashing into each other. This was supposed to be like a stock car race, and now it's a demolition derby. And everybody's crashing around. They're shooting guns at this thing.
There's something really cool about Tracy here, because Tracy's the one driving the car. This is the big chase scene in this movie, and she's the one driving. I like it. And she does a really good job. They actually end up on a rally course at some point, and she's like driving against rally drivers while having cars chasing her, shooting guns at her, and she totally keeps her cool. I really like her a lot.
And we end with a pretty sick stunt where the bad guy's car flips over, and then the Contessa makes her way out. Some cops like trying to stop her. She just like drives at him like such a psycho that he has to jump out of the way because he knows she's not going to stop for him.
I love how Spectre has all these matching orange jumpsuits.
They end up spending the night together, of course, and Bond's like, I'm gonna marry you. Unfortunately, being a spy isn't really conducive to marriage, and she's like, well, I understand, I guess we won't get married. And he's like, no, you misunderstand. I'm gonna marry you, I'm just gonna stop being a spy. And you're like, holy shit, Bond's gonna give it all up for this woman. That's amazing, it's crazy, what a beautiful love story. He did just sleep with two women at the chalet like less than 24 hours ago. And I do wonder if he told her about that. Because, like, listen, Bond gets around, and that, whatever, that's fine. He's very abusive to women. That's not okay. But just the fact that he sleeps with a bunch of women, I'm fine with, as long as he's open with her about it. You know? That's all I ask.
The next day, we get another awesome ski scene. We've got the Contessa, and we've got Bond, and they are going down the mountain together.
Of course, the next day, Blofeld's goons find them, and so they're skiing again, another skiing chase scene.
And it's pretty cool. Like, it makes me really wish I could get out and go skiing, but barring that, pretty awesome to watch some of the tricks they're doing. She ramps off of a building. That's pretty amazing. They jump over a track.
I have two favorite kills in this movie. The first is when Bond hits one of the skiers' pursuers, and the guy flips end over end off the mountain. That was just brutal. The follow-up throwing the guy off wasn't as bad, but geez, the first guy, like, the camera follows him all the way down till a thud.
Which has my absolute favorite death in it, because, like, this is this big chase scene. Blofeld's even out here. Blofeld's is cool in this movie. That's something I didn't mention before, but he's not the, like, weird, like, hunched over dude he was in You Only Live Twice. He's, like, cool, and he's got swagger and wears smoking jackets. But he also skis. Like, he's part of the ski pursuit for Bond.
My favorite kill from this episode is definitely when Bond is at the edge of the cliff face there, and the guys are coming down, and some dude is like mid super sick trick, and Bond clubs him, like clotheslines him with a ski, and the dude just falls forever. He falls so much until he finally hits the ground. I just love that. The guy's 1 minute he's into X Games, the next minute he is just falling for, like, I don't know, like a minute and a half of real time. It's amazing.
And they're like going down the mountainside. He's got all these goons with him, and Bond sees like a snow plow, like kicking up a bunch of snow. I think it's trying to make fresh powder on the mountainside, basically. And they like jump over the ditch that it's in. And then the girl jumps over the ditch that it's in. And then some of the goons fall in the ditch. And one of the goons gets sucked up by the snow plow.
But it's the moment when the skier tries to jump the path, but gets dismembered by the plow.
Favorite kill would be that moment where the skiing henchman gets churned up in the industrial snowplow.
Probably very close second favorite kill is when the dude gets mulched by the snowcat.
The second, which I'm guessing more people liked, was a guy getting sucked into the snowblower machine.
Ouch.
Tries to make the jump, doesn't hit it, hits the ground, snowcat runs him over.
And it's super bloody because it's sending out snow behind it, and suddenly all the snow is red.
And it is just blood tornado for a while.
Bond says to Tracy,
he had a lot of guts.
And Bond turns to Tracy and says, he had a lot of guts.
As guts are just falling from the sky.
Like, so much blood comes out of this guy, and even James Bond comments on it when he says, that guy had a lot of guts.
Because they're flying all over. Do you get it? Because his guts are flying all over.
Oh, yeah.
It's, yeah. Anyway.
My favorite kills are both of the kills where James Bond throws a person off a cliff.
You know, there's some weird parts in this movie, but something that stood out is Blofeld takes part in like the 2-day cross-country chase after Bond. He carries a weapon, gets his hands dirty. He's a decent skier, too. He's even the one that starts the avalanche that leads to Tracy being caught. Though he acts like a lovesick puppy when he has Tracy alone, so that's creepy.
And just when it looks like Bond and Tracy are about to get away, Blofeld launches a like a explosive or flare, a firework, up at the side of the mountain and causes an avalanche, which comes cascading down and buries them both.
Blofeld sends a couple of his dudes out to chase Bond through this kind of difficult little gully, and then he triggers an avalanche, which will kill them and kill Bond, and he doesn't care about his own guys because he's Blofeld, and that's how evil geniuses roll. Creates this really huge avalanche, and there's some really awesome footage of this avalanche. Like, those are very, very scary things for skiers, and it's amazing. And Bond escapes, but the Contessa, she's trapped underneath it, and now Bond's got to go rescue her.
And he thinks Bond is dead, but he takes the girl as an insurance policy, I guess. And then it turns out Bond's fine.
Bond goes back to M, and he wants to mount a mission to go rescue his girl.
we cut back to London, where Bond is in MI6 headquarters. He's in M's office. He's flashing back to Tracy being dragged away by Blofeld, and he's being told by M that the governments of the world are acquiescing. They're giving Blofeld what he wants, which is that when Blofeld retires from his life of crime, all of his crimes are going to be forgiven, and he will get to be a legitimate count.
And M is not going to do it. He's got his orders. United Nations called, and they're going to offer Blofeld amnesty. Great.
Blofeld wins. And Bond's like, M, all we have to do is show up at Blofeld's place, blow it up, and then he can't control the brainwashed woman, he can't release the poison, and we win. And M's like, yeah, but it's too risky. We can't do it. And Bond's like, I understand.
Well, Bond's not going to put up with that. Bond calls up his buddy. He calls up her dad. And they put together a rescue mission.
So then he goes off book again and calls up his gangster friend, a future father-in-law, and is like, hey, I need a whole bunch of your gangsters to help me come blow away this mansion.
The rescue mission is we're going to roll up in 3 Red Cross helicopters, white with the Red Cross painted on them, and then we're just going to immediately start chucking grenades and machine gunning everybody out of it.
This movie also has a really good use of the Bond theme during the fight scene towards the end, during the battle at Blofeld's base.
And they go in helicopters, and there's a full-on assault on the ski lodge by gangsters. Bond's teamed up with, like, the mafia in this? And they blow that thing to hell.
And it is a pretty awesome attack sequence. And while that's going on, we've got the Contessa. She's breaking out, and she has a pretty decent fight with one of Blofeld's top guys, right? They're fighting. She threatens him with a broken glass. She hits him with a champagne bottle. They're going back and forth.
Why are there spikes on the wall?
Finally, she impales him on a piece of art, and he dies.
Oh, that's why there's spikes on the wall.
Heroes come, they find her. James Bond, like, hey, what's up? Some dude shows up. He immediately machine guns that guy, and then he's like, well, you should probably get out of here, because I gotta kill a bunch more guys.
Favorite vehicle is a toss-up between Bond's muscle car and the bobsled.
Okay. Battle continues. Blofeld is getting away, and he's getting away in probably one of the most amazing ways you can imagine. He is going to take a bobsled and run it down the bobsled track. And James Bond, of course, there's a second bobsled. He's got to get on his bobsled. We got a bobsled race.
And then there's this chase scene where Bond is chasing Blofeld down a bobsled run.
I really enjoyed the bobsled chase, the fact that there were not just one, but 2 bobsleds.
One thing during this race, there's pretty awesome stunt work while these guys are beating each other up on the bobsled. When they, like, there's some sequences that you can see, like, the guys are really fighting on these bobsleds that are hauling down the hill, and it's pretty impressive.
Perfect for this chase was hilarious. A lot of the times Blofeld or Bond was also just driving one-handed, which made it even more confusing. But like most Bond movies, I just suspended reality and enjoyed the chase scene.
One thing that this sequence really raises as a question for me is, how the hell are you supposed to steer that thing? What is that? It looks like metal and like leather straps, and I have no idea what's going on here. And it seems very difficult to try to steer that by holding both metal straps with one hand and shooting a gun with the other hand. But, you know, that's why I'm not James Bond.
I'm really confused that the bobsled seems so easy to drive with just one person.
Some really cool stunts. James Bond ends up winning the fight when he kicks Blofeld up into a tree, breaks his neck on the tree branch.
Eventually, Blofeld, like, his head gets stuck in a tree? Like, on a tree branch? And Bond's like, oh, he took a branching path or something like that. He quips to himself. There's no one around. He still says a one-liner.
Keeps going, loses control a little bit, levels it out.
My only bobsled point of reference is from Cool Runnings, really, and they had trouble with all 4 of them in there.
Bobsled crashes. I'm kind of surprised it didn't explode.
And then that's just where that ends. Like, Blofeld is fine, I guess. Bond leaves him hanging from a tree on a mountainside and is like, I guess that's fine.
Bond lands. He's fine. Pops up. Takes his helmet off. He's not even broken a sweat. A dog comes over. He pets that. He's like, hey, dog, give me some Hennessy.
And goes off and gets married.
Okay, that's how Bond ends this stuff.
And you're like, what is happening in this movie? Bond's actually getting married?
I really do like the love story in this movie. I just feel like, in retrospect, it's not quite earned.
I do think the proposal of marriage is out of right field. Like, really, James? You hooked up with, like, so many girls, and this is the one?
Unfortunately, it's all kind of undermined by the fact that while Bond is in Blofeld's lair, he sleeps with several women.
I mean, you were literally in someone's bed, like, 12 hours before.
The whole time I was like, but what about Tracy? I thought you loved her. And then he got married with her afterwards. I guess Bond hanging out at Blofeld's lair was kind of like his bachelor party? I don't know.
And then James and Tracy gets married!
And it's, you know, it's a nice little wedding. Like, M is there, and Q is there, and Moneypenny's there, and she's all tearful about it, and then Bond tosses her his hat just like old times. It's really good.
Bond gets married at the end of this, and we haven't really seen that before. We don't see it again. And very interesting, he marries a countess. He becomes, you know, I don't know if he becomes a count. I don't know how this stuff works.
I never remember much about this movie, except for it's the one where, one, George Lazenby shows up and wears a lot of frilly shirts, and two, James Bond gets married.
So yeah, this movie sort of ends on a cliffhanger. And I say sort of because is it really a cliffhanger if the next movie doesn't really address what had happened in the previous movie?
I usually watch these with my husband, but time got away from us this week. I had to watch the last 30 minutes on my own.
And it ends very sadly, like 4 minutes later.
Big mistake.
She wasn't expecting that.
I came and found him bawling when I finished it, asking how he could let me watch the end on my own, knowing what was going to happen.
I think my wife is actually still crying a few days later after watching this movie.
This is not the Bond movie I had come to expect.
Bit of a weird ending to this one, right? Because you've got all of this kind of ridiculous, fun, amazing stuff happening, and at the end, but yeah, kind of an interesting ending.
So, spoilers for a movie that came out in the 60s. After defeating Blofeld's evil plot once again, Bond gets married, and he and Tracy are about to drive off into the sunset.
And they drive off. Happily ever after. Anyway, then she gets shot.
When she gets killed in a drive-by shooting by Blofeld's henchwoman.
Who kills his love at the end of the film as well.
The top villain moment for me is definitely kind of that, just the killing of Tracy, you know. And I think it is an inadvertent killing. You know, unfortunately, Tracy gets caught in between Bond and Blofeld, and she's the one that ends up getting killed, and it's definitely the most villainous part of the movie.
The way that scene's played is so well done. It's so heartbreaking and tragic.
When Bond is mourning for the death of Tracy, and he's holding her.
And then a cop pulls up and is like, hey, what's going on? And Bond is like, it's fine, she's just resting. There's no rush, you see.
And just says, she's quite all right. She's just having a bit of a rest. And we have all the time in the world.
We have all the time in the world.
It really is a beautiful moment at the end with Bond holding Tracy.
So just seeing Bond in what is at this point the most vulnerable we've ever seen Bond is something that I don't think Sean Connery could have done. And I don't think George Lazenby gets enough credit for his portrayal of Bond, but this is just a scene that it just knocks you over.
I think they really hit on the one huge fear every significant other has of losing the love of their life.
And she gets married to Bond and is immediately killed in a drive-by by Blofeld.
And then the movie ends.
So we get a little bit of Casino Royale here. We get a little bit of the second Bourne movie.
With Bond's wife having just been shot on their wedding day.
Yeah, pretty dark stuff. We got a pretty dark ending to this one. It's a super bummer after having such like an interesting and exciting and weird, cool, like quirky movie to have this girl just get capped at the end of it. But makes the whole thing carry a little bit more weight, and it makes George Lazenby's appearance as Bond very memorable.
This movie has a really good use of the Bond theme during the fight scene towards the end, but then it also has one of the worst uses of the Bond theme, which plays over the credits after one of the most heartbreaking cliffhangers in movie history.
What is this movie?
But the whole movie, you really do see some real emotion from Bond, besides sarcasticness. I'm not sure Connery could have played this part. While being chased in the carnival, he shows fear. He shows love to Tracy, frustration at M, and eventually sadness at Tracy's death. It's like Bond's a real person in this movie.
What really gets me is that because Lazenby left the role and Sean Connery came back for the next movie, they never really followed this up. I'll talk about this more when we get to Diamonds Are Forever. They kind of follow up, but they really don't. It's just tonally, Diamonds Are Forever is just an off-the-wall, cheesy, campy-as-it-gets Bond movie, whereas this is trying to take the material seriously.
I get that they wanted, we're bringing in a new Bond. Let's do something a little bit different. Let's do something a little bit more down to earth. Let's do something a little bit more dramatic. But holy shit, what? That's not how movies end.
But yeah, that's a pretty crappy way to end what could have been a decent happy ending. James's actual emotions in one of the saddest moments of James Bond until Casino Royale.
And you never really get closure on this scene until you get to Roger Moore's For Your Eyes Only. In my headcanon, that movie takes place after this. Diamonds Are Forever never happened. We'll get into that next time.
I really don't know what to expect going into the next movie after how real this one was.
That was On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Thanks so much.
James Bond will return in Diamonds Are Forever.
Podcasters Assemble Season 003 is a production of the We Can Make This Work Probably Podcast Network. Find more of our shows at probablywork.com and learn how to contribute to future episodes of Podcasters Assemble by looking us up on Twitter at Casters Assemble or joining our Discord server, link in the show notes. Submissions are always open. Thank you to everyone who was able to contribute to this episode. Be sure to check the show notes for links where you can find them all online. Thank you.
This has been a presentation
of the We Can Make This Work
Probably Network.
Follow us on Twitter
at Probably Work for more of our questionable content.
Also, we have a website called probablywork.com.
Bond gets married to the Contessa. We haven't seen this before, and we don't see this again until the Casino Royale. No, wait, does he marry her in Casino Royale? I don't think he does.
And they drive off happily ever after. With, talking about the Bond family crest is, you have all the time in the world. Oh, wait, no, it was, the world is not enough. Anyway, then she gets shot.
Podcasters Assemble will return in Diamonds Are Forever.